welcome to tonight's edition of the Juliana Forlano Show, coming to you from Brooklyn, New York. Guess what? We have two awesome segments for you tonight. First part of the show, we are going to talk about what the Pope is doing. He's doing something that's rather activist-oriented, I would say. We're going to be joined by the director of the Office of the Americas, Blaise Bonpane, to talk about that. Then in the second half of the show, what is mansplaining? Have you been mansplained? Jennifer Posner, media critic and media literacy speaker and educator, joins us to talk about that. But not until we have this word from our non-sponsor. After a little piece from the folks at the Final Edition. Stay with us.
America. Throw a brick off a highway overpass. Appear naked on YouTube, then read the comments. Bring back polio. When police ask you for identification, show them a condom. Marry a stripper named Poison, then take her camping. Strippers named Poison love camping. Get a McDonald's menu tattooed on your face. Freedom isn't free. Jeb Bush, 2016.
I am spitting coffee all over the place here because I didn't hear that last one before I played it. I just trusted that it was going to be funny. Listen, this is very exciting. We have a new segment coming up. First of all, let me give you some background. Pope Francis decreed on Tuesday that slain Salvadorian Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was killed in 1980, was killed out of hatred for his Catholic faith, thus approving a martyrdom declaration that sets the stage for his beatification. This is very interesting and very important in a number of ways. He's going against what popes before him have done. We're going to talk about this with our next guest in our new segment called City of Pope Francis. Again, the audacity of Pope Francis. You really can't get enough of the audacity of Pope Francis. The audacity of Pope Francis. All right, enough kidding around. Joining us on the phone to discuss what Pope Francis has done and why this is so important, Blaise Bonpane. Blaise is the director of the Office of the Americas. Bonpane served as the Mary Knoll priest in Guatemala and has written 5 books, including Guerrillas of Peace, Liberation Theology, and the Central American Revolution. His most recent book is his autobiography called Imagine No Religion. Mr. Bonpane, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Juliana. It's good to be here.
Am I pronouncing your name properly?
You're pronouncing it correctly, which is good bread in Italian, but because it's anglicized so much, it's always called Bonpane.
Nah, Bonpane.
Exactly.
So, Mr. Bonpane, could you tell us the significance of Pope Francis's decree about Oscar Romero?
Well, it was really a response to Pope John Paul II, who forced Archbishop Romero to wait for weeks in Rome and wouldn't talk to him, as Romero was desperately trying to explain the situation in El Salvador. And that particular pope, John Paul II, was very concerned about the rise of liberation theology, which gave this preferential option to the poor of the earth.
Mm. Really, can we talk about?
Challenge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can we talk about what was happening there? And also, if you could, I know this is a big question, and we could spend the whole show on it. But if you could talk a little bit about the difference between Catholicism as practiced by non-liberation theology Catholics and what a liberation theology married with a Catholicism would mean.
Well, the difference is this, that liberation theology really is an attack on imperial theology, which began in 312 AD with the Council of Nicaea, where the Emperor Constantine invited the bishops to come to Nicaea and to form a creed for the Unam Sanctam Catholicam, the one holy church, together with the one empire, and to unite the two. And the concept was, this creed is it, and those who disagree with us will be eliminated. He put the Greek kyro on the Roman shield. The Romans loved Greek, and that was the symbol of Christ, and that this was the message to the world now, and we won't tolerate anything else. Well, liberation theology wants to go back prior to the Nicene Council and to talk about the actual teachings of Jesus rather than an imperial creed created by an emperor, which led to terribly muscular Christianity, which followed the Council of Nicaea, leading to things like crusades, which are so important to study today, because at that time the Christians were eliminating, in the time of the crusades, they were eliminating people of Islamic faith and the Jewish faith because they felt they were infidels. And today we see a reversal going on. It would help us so much to understand history if we all went back to a liberation theology which attacks man-made doctrines.
That's very it's very interesting. President Obama recently said at the National Prayer Breakfast a couple of weeks ago, he made, you know, verbal note of actual history when he said that we should all remember that there are other religions other than Islam that have a history of violence against what they consider, as the word you just used, infidels. And he got a lot of pushback from the right wing about having basically just said what we all know from studying history. I think that's very interesting.
Well, I differ so much with so many things Obama does, but I think he was completely correct in his analysis there. The Crusades were nothing to be proud of. Mm. You see a wonderful coverage by Susan Jacoby in the New York Times for last Sunday, A Religious Conversion, A Secular History. She wrote the book, and it includes this reference to the Crusades, of how Christian soldiers opposed this Islam and also Judaism, and this began in 1096, and so it's the use of religion for political purposes, and we feel that imperial theology not only gave us the Crusades, it gave us the Inquisition, it gave us the conquistadores, it gave us the idea that God is on our side, which was one of the great jokes of all history, if it wasn't so tragic.
You said that you can actually see this idea of muscular Christianity in things like the movie American Sniper. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, my God. Fox News referred to the sniper as saying, well, Jesus would have been a sniper, you know.
Oh, my God.
I mean, this is how people play with religion, and they're speaking for themselves. They're not. Many of them have no understanding at all of what they are talking about in this type of issue. Did I mention to you the book Mirrors by Eduardo Galeano?
No, go ahead. What is the book?
Okay, I would like to reference that book. He's a great writer, and he speaks about the death of Romero. And here is Romero going to Rome, and he says, in the spring of 1979, Archbishop of El Salvador, Oscar Arnulfo Romero, traveled to the Vatican. He asked, pleaded, begged for an audience with Pope John Paul II. Wait your turn. We do not know. Come back tomorrow. At the end, lining up with the faithful, waiting to be blessed, just among one of many, he surprised His Holiness and managed to steal a few minutes with him. Romero tried to deliver a voluminous report with photographs and testimony, but the Pope handed it back. I don't have time to read all this. Romero sputtered that thousands of Salvadorans had been tortured and murdered by the military, among them many Catholics, five priests, and just yesterday, on the eve of this audience, the army had riddled 25 people with bullets in the doorway of the cathedral. Mm. The head of the church stopped him right there. Mr. Archbishop, do not exaggerate. The meeting did not last much longer. St. Peter's successor demanded, commanded, ordered, quote, you must reach an understanding with the government. A good Christian does not look for trouble with the authorities.
I'm sorry. That made me mad. Keep going.
Yeah, 10 months later, Archbishop Romero was shot down in El Salvador. The bullet that killed him as he was saying Mass at the moment he raised the host from Rome, the pontiff condemned the crime. He forgot to condemn the criminals. Years later, in Cuscatlan Park, names on an infinitely long wall to commemorate the civilian victims of the war. Thousands upon thousands of names are etched in white on black marble. The letters of Archbishop Romero's name are the only ones that show wear from the touch of so many fingers. Mm. Eduardo Galeano from the book Mirrors.
And this was under John Paul II,
yes,
Pope John Paul II. Let's talk a little bit about the tenets of liberation theology. What we understand now that imperial theology is basically a joining of the church with the state for the purpose of oppressing the people, I would go so far as to say. But liberation theology, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, liberation theology really wants to question dogmatism. It wants to question the sectarianism. It wants to get away from the sectarianism and dogmatism and have a reverence with a very serious critique of what's going on and a respect for other efforts to show our theism. It's really not agnostic. It's not atheistic. It's highly theistic, but it's very much against the formalism, the legalism, the top-down authoritarianism of the church. And it gives we see elements of this throughout history. The sensus fidelium is even referred to in church law. It's the sense of the faithful. The faithful canonized Archbishop Romero years ago, but now the church may follow.
As a former Catholic myself,
yes.
One of the things that really disturbed me personally is having to have some guy, always a guy.
Yes.
I mean, possibly a nun, but not really. They certainly weren't as respected in the church where I was growing up as the priest. It had to be some man stood between me and my sense of what was right and what was wrong and my sense of, any knowledge of any kind of greater power or whatever you want to call it. People call it God. People call it other things. And my understanding was that liberation theology talks about it. You can have a direct knowledge of like the force of God or whatever you want to call it. And that understanding will lead you directly to opposing unjust social and political structures.
It gives a great deal of emphasis on conscience. And conscience, even as you look at the existing church, the voice of conscience is more important to follow than the voice of the Pope. That's the reality of the Catholic Church as it stands. People often don't know that.
Well, I never heard that. I always heard whatever the Pope is, you got to do that.
We have to act in accord with our conscience rather than anything else. And that's what led so many of us to move away from the institutionalized religion that was so top-down and so disrespectful, you might say, of the individuals. And that's why the liberation theology people created what are called base communities, small groups of people gathering together, observing, and then judging, and then acting on what they thought they should do. For example, in El Salvador, it's utterly amazing what the people would do. They'd gather, they'd pray, they'd recite verses from Scripture, and then they'd say, look, there are helicopters flying over killing us, and we don't think we should tolerate that. In one case, they said, all right, we don't want to hurt the pilots. Let's go to the Ilopango Air Base, where these helicopters are based, and let's destroy them on the ground. And they did that. That was a decision of a base community, small community of people doing what Jesus said, where two or three are gathered in my name, I will be there in the midst of them and bless them. In other words, people solving their problems directly. And how often these base communities agreed with each other. They had, they'd come to the same conclusion on the matter of war and peace. And the church has been terribly slow to condemn war. It even had this awful theory of the just war, which came from St. Augustine and even St. Thomas Aquinas. There's no such thing as a just aggressive war. Aggressive
war,
the most evil thing imaginable on the planet. But
can we get you on Meet the Press? I would love to hear that. I would love to hear anyone in mainstream media say that there is no such thing as a just war. I you just don't hear that enough. You hear it on WBAI, of course, and you hear it on my show, of course. But God, you just don't hear it enough. Cornel West will say,
you know, Juliana, you hear it in international law. It's the gravest crime in international law is what's called aggressive war. That's what the just war theory has tried to justify over the years as empire goes into an attack on the one place or another, whether it's killing Muslims or Jews or whoever it's killing. They're justifying it, saying this is a just war. And I can imagine, you know, maybe a pilot flying back from what he thinks is a just war after he's just bombed 2,000 people, coming in, landing, and then going to confession that he missed Mass on Sunday. Well, I mean, please, we have work to do here, and I think that the time has come for liberation theology to be understood. And I think that Pope Francis knows this, and in a certain way, he's locked in. He's locked into a really tight situation, and every time he says something, the curia get very upset. Now, that word curia is right out of the Roman Empire. The structure of the Vatican was taken directly from Roman imperial structure, including the curia. So he knows he has problems there. He's going to have to deal with things that were called dogmas, and have to deal with the fact that they shouldn't be called dogmas any more than limbo.
Limbo. They voted that out.
Never mind. Well, how many millions of women were told, your child, will not have the beatific vision, but your child will have purely natural happiness. Thank you very much. And you can't be buried in the regular part of the cemetery of the Catholic Church.
I mean, all of these things are really kind of ridiculous. And we're coming, unfortunately, we're coming close to the end of the time. So I wanted to ask you a couple of specific questions, and then you're going to have to come back, because this liberation theology discussion, I think we need to have a whole show that's on every day about liberation theology and how it applies to everything that's happening in the world. You say that Pope Ratzinger, you called him the Inquisitor, and that he came in as the Pope and was attacking and shutting people up, and that's the reason why you left the clergy. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, he certainly wasn't Pope when I left the clergy. However, the Superior General of our order put me under a gag order, and I realized that I could not comply with a gag order when people's lives depended on me, and so I was sent to Hawaii and told to shut up and not to say anything. So I received a call from the Washington Post and flew back from Hawaii to Washington, D.C., and had a 3-hour meeting with the editorial board and released everything I had from Guatemala. And that was important to me because I could have been quiet and lived a nice, peaceful life in Hawaii, but it would have been absolutely impossible for my conscience.
Ah, the conscience. Yes, of course.
The Post released the story about Guatemala, our Latin Vietnam, to some 500 papers, and I was able to show that we are intervening in the lives of innocent people and killing them on a grand scale, not only in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, but also in Central America, where literally hundreds of thousands have died. And if you go through all of the Americas, millions have died because of their faith, in really practicing compassion and love and not bending down to a state-controlled type of church where the church follows the state. And it has done that for centuries, and it must not do that.
Do you still practice as a spiritual or religious leader, maybe not under the guise of the church?
Oh, yes. I'm a firm believer in meditation, in prayer, in reflection. I'm not at all excited by the pop atheists that come along. I feel many of them sound to me like some kind of fundamentalist with cyclic type of reasoning, saying there is no God. Because
Well, they always seem very angry. That's one thing.
Yeah,
they just don't feel happy.
We don't want to be angry. We want to practice what are called the fruits of the Spirit, which are like the electricity that you can see in those who are in touch with reality, and those fruits are called peace, patience, love, compassion, courage, the ability to endure. These things are visible in people, and they're visible in people, some people who cannot affirm the existence of God. Some people,
yes, so it doesn't really matter
refer
about
to themselves
the God thing.
As atheists because of all the horrible things they heard about God. And many people who have a religion. But it's very clear, I think, to everyone that the name of our religion doesn't tell you anything about us. I can be a Catholic saint or a Catholic rapist, and that applies to everybody. The name of the religion is really quite irrelevant in terms of who you are, and that the important thing is behavior that shows love and compassion and concern. And now we have this terrible, freak academic thing coming out called the post-humanist era. Well, that's an invention, I think, of the military-industrial complex.
What is the post-humanist era?
There isn't going to be a post-humanist era.
What are they talking about when they say the post-humanist era?
They're talking about not making value judgments. They're talking about
that sounds nice, a life with no values.
Adapting to nuclear war, adapting to intervening in 13 countries in as many years.
Oh, my God.
And we don't do that. That's not something we do. So they can take their so-called post-humanist approach, which is
stuff it up their
Wall Street approach. It absolutely has no merit in any form of life. I call people who follow it would be humanoids. They look like humans, but they're not practicing human reality. And many of them have their nation as their faith, like the American exceptionalism, is a religion, that we have a right to send drones over to kill people. We don't have the right to do that, no right whatsoever.
Mr. Bonpon, just another quick question here, and then we're almost out of time, but another quick question. Do you think, and we were getting back to Pope Francis because we've been following him, because I have a person in my family who is a Catholic priest, and he said to me that this pope is no different from the pope before, the pope before that. The media is just making a big deal out of it. And I spit my drink out, cleaned myself up and said, no, the media is not only making a big deal about it because we have a person in a position of power who is talking about things that usually have to be whispered about or talked about on, you know, independent public radio like WBAI. So what do you believe that Pope Francis has? And he's not perfect. He said things I still dislike. But do you think that he has allies around him? And what
No, I think so. It reminds me of Pope John the 23rd, who called the Vatican Council from 1962 to 1965. He was an aged revolutionary, and we were in the field in the wake of that council, and we heard things coming from him saying, look, make up your mind in the field how to enter into the hopes, desires, and anxieties of your people, hasta las últimas consecuencias, wherever it takes you. And everything changed. He turned the church upside down, and then those who followed him tried to turn it back where it was again.
I have to tell you,
one time he was asked by corporate people who were coming from the States to study the Vatican. They said, well, Your Holiness, how many people work here in the Vatican? And he said, about half of them.
Well, one time when I started hearing the Pope say that, when you grow up with something and it's so close to you, because as a religion would be, it's very, very close to you. It's part of the culture. It's part of your heart, et cetera. And then you fall away from that. It's a very difficult falling away. And when I heard this Pope say things like climate change is real and, you know, whatever the other things that are that I it just had a real I don't know. I felt energy shoot through me. Not like I'm going to go back, but I just felt it was there was justice there in what he was saying. What do you think the ramifications, and we have about a minute, I'm so sorry, left, the ramifications of Pope Francis declaring Oscar Romero a martyr will be?
Well, I think they're very important because they tell us really, take it with a grain of salt, as my mother used to say. As Southern Italians, many of them were quite anti-clerical in spite of the fact that they were very Catholic, but they had a critical sense. And they'd say, take it with a grain of salt. Don't listen to these imperial-sounding people. Listen to those who are in touch with those at the grassroots. And they know what they're talking about. So I do think it's very important that he's there, and I do think the message is very important, and I do think the message of conscience is absolutely essential. Many Catholics have been pained and have worked against their better interests because they followed some ecclesiastical law rather than following their own lights, which would have been much, much better. So it is an important time, but I do feel a sense of Pope Francis being hemmed in by a very strong institution and by many people that don't seem to like him very much. But I think we have to realize that we don't depend on an institution, and I don't think God has any religion. I mean, why would God have a religion? His religion. He's there, and the importance of any institution is the importance of one grain of sand in the universe. So we must not give too much worship to either the state or the church, and realize that we transcend that with an authentic spirituality that is not bound by dogmas, not bound by rules of, in this case, men, and is really boundless in its greatness.
We've been speaking with Blaise Bonpane, the director of the Office of the Americas. The book that you suggested, can you repeat the name of it?
The one from Galeano?
Yes.
That book is called Mirrors by Eduardo Galeano. It was published in 2009 by Nation Books, and he has there his commentary on Archbishop Romero's visit to the Vatican, and it's being pushed aside by Pope John Paul II.
And you can also find Mr. Bonpane's books, including The Guerrillas of Peace, Liberation Theology, and the Central American Revolution, and your most recent book, your autobiography, Imagine No Religion. Thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you very much, Julian. I look forward to that.
That was an absolute pleasure. You're listening to the Juliana Forlano Show. We'll be right back with Jen Posner after this. We'll be right back. How'd you like that? Blaise Bonpane, that was very interesting. You're listening to the Giuliana Forlano Show, and you'll be able to chime in with your thoughts here at the Giuliana Forlano Show if you're listening between 6 and 7 p.m. I know we have other people listening at other times, and pretty soon we're going to be setting up a listener line so you can call and leave us your thoughts, and we will play them on a future show. I know I've had that request several times. Keep your ears peeled for it. Our number here, if you are listening between 6 and 7, is 718-951-4444. Give us a call with your thoughts. Joining us now, as we discussed earlier, we got a new guest. It's very exciting. Listen, I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but this concept, there's a concept out there called mansplaining, which we're going to talk to our next guest, Jennifer Posner, media critic, media literacy speaker, and educator, is joining us for our new segment that we like to call
Reports from Vajistan. Vajistan.
Jennifer Posner joining us. She's the founder and director of Women in Media and News, an organization which increases women's presence and power in public debate. Her first book, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, was called Required Reading for Every American Girl and Woman by Melissa Harris Perry. People at the Colbert Report love her. She is fab. Jennifer, thanks for joining us on the air.
Thank you, Giuliana. I'm cracking up here about that Vajistan.
Do you like that
intro?
You like that? We had a good time making that. Can you? Do you know what the background song is?
No, I couldn't. It was a little fuzzy. I couldn't quite tell.
Okay, if anyone is out there listening and can tell what the song is, I will send you one of our books from the Laughing Liberally for free. Letters to an American Voter. It's funny books. The song behind that. I'll play it again after this segment. But I want to get right to it, Jennifer, because you and I have discussed this personally off the air, this idea of mansplaining. Can you tell the audience what is mansplaining? How did it come about?
Well, okay, so the concept of mansplaining sort of was born when the internet discovered an essay that was written by writer Rebecca Solnit about how she was documenting this phenomenon in which men assume that women basically know nothing and so decide that it's their responsibility and even more their sort of right as human beings to tell women all about everything that they should know, even when, in fact, those men don't have expertise in the particular field that they're trying to educate women about, and women are actually the experts. So Rebecca wrote this essay called Men Explain Things to Me several years ago. And she told this anecdote to kick off the essay about being at a cocktail party with, she was a young woman and she was with another young woman, and she had just written a number of books, one of which was about a foreign policy issue. And she went to this cocktail party, and an older man in a, you know, very sort of collegiate tweed at elbow patches jacket was holding forth and trying to charm the young women by droning on about all the things he was so, you know, supposedly knowledgeable about. And he started to mention, he asked her what her field was, and she mentioned something about that particular foreign policy field that she had just written the book about, but she didn't mention that she wrote the book off the top of her head. And he goes, oh, well, if you're interested in that subject, you must read this new book. This new book is so important. You must read this book. Starts going on and on about the book she wrote, not realizing she wrote it, and her, but assuming that even though that's her field, that she wouldn't have read this new book. And her companion said that actually she wrote that book. And the guy could not even hear that concept that the woman he was talking to wrote the book he was raving about was so unfathomable to him that he couldn't even hear her friend say that she was the author. So her friend had to say it a number of times, and when he finally realized that he was actually lecturing this woman about the book that she already wrote, and he, it turns out, didn't even read, he just read a review of it, he just sort of mumbled and walked away. When Rebecca's essay hit the internet, blogs and social media folks and women basically everywhere took to this essay like it was new language. In the same way that when the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings happened, all of a sudden people started, women started talking about sexual harassment because they had a name for it. So mansplaining is basically this concept where women have finally, there's a term now that we can use for the widespread cultural phenomenon that's happened all the time that we didn't up until recently realize was happening to almost all women all the time.
Now, what is the difference between someone just being a jerk and someone mansplaining?
Ah, very good question. I get this question all the time, usually from men on the internet.
I knew they were going to call
me. Women explain things to them, so therefore mansplaining isn't a thing. Here's the thing. Anybody can be a jerk. Anybody can say, oh, I know more than you about that. But the thing with mansplaining is that it is often, I'll give you an example in my day-to-day life. I'm a media critic, I'm a journalist, I'm a media expert. I have 20 years plus of experience in this field. Men regularly try to tell me that men regularly assume that I don't know anything about the media, and they do, even though that generally the men who are trying to explain this to me so gallantly have no idea what they're talking about. In my book, Reality Bites Back, there are two chapters specifically about media economics, and then as well an analysis and detailed documentation research about advertising and media consolidation and its impact on content over the last 25 years in media. Men will regularly try to tell me on the internet and even in person that, you know, but you need to understand, Jennifer, the media is a business. I mean, there are financial interests at stake. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Well, okay, yeah, no, you can possibly understand
that. Two chapters in my book about those financial interests at stake. Oh, no, you just watch TV one time? Great. I know you know more than me because you watch TV one time. That's great.
I think this happens to all of us. I was at a show performing the other day, and I had a really great set. Everyone was, the audience really enjoyed it. And when I came off, a man said, hey, you know, you should record that and put it somewhere. And you really should. No, you should. That was good. And I was thinking, yeah, I know it was good. Thank you kind of for the compliment. I'm a professional, so I would hope that it would be good because that's my job. That's what I've been doing for years. And also there's a reason I don't record it and throw it up for free on the internet. Hello, artists aren't just supposed to, you know, but there's no use in talking back. I was reading about the power dynamic and why, you know, it's not just being a jerk. It's being a jerk based in the fact that men, and specifically white men, are, you know, have been in a position, you know, of power for years. And there's this sort of privilege, I guess is the word, maybe not power, but the privilege that underlies these interactions that people don't understand. And that's what makes mansplaining different than just being a jerk being arrogant.
I think that what you're touching on is very key, because it's not necessarily the same kind of power dynamic that makes men be physically abusive to women, right? When we think of when an average person thinks of a power dynamic, usually they're thinking of some sort of physical abuse situation, right? But with mansplaining, when I say it's a cultural phenomenon, the power dynamic is about entitlement and the assumption that knowledge belongs to men, and that women don't have it, right? Or at least don't have it nearly to an equal level intellectually as men do. For example, I mean, I think back to Larry Summers at Harvard, who had explained that the reason there weren't as many women on the tenure track at Harvard is just, you know, women weren't as good at science as men were. And it's like, well, you know, you have no business running a university if you believe women are intellectually inferior to their male colleagues. And if you don't actually recognize that there are systemic discrimination issues at play on your tenure track within your university, and that you're going to blame those systemic discrimination issues, those structural bias issues, on women's intellectual inferiority, you need to get out of academia, right?
The same problem happens in
a classic mansplaining issue.
The same problem happens in comedy, and we're seeing this all over the place now. With someone saying, with a lot of people are saying, Jon Stewart is retiring. We should put a woman in that chair. Or is a woman even being considered? And my thought is, it'd be great if a woman was considered, of course. But there are going to be reasons why women aren't considered, and it's going to get me in trouble if I really say how I really feel. So maybe I'm going to hold back a little bit. Audience. But the issue is that there aren't a lot of spaces for women to be, you know, Jon Stewart has a certain gravitas in addition to his ability to be funny. So he is
But he didn't have that gravitas when he first got the show. He was allowed to grow with the show. So this is a separate thing from mansplaining.
Don't
we can
mansplain
talk about
the
I think we should do the next Vagistan on the Daily Show, and I'll come back and we'll talk about that.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea, because we might be
too, just because I don't want to leave too. I don't want to go off too much on the Daily Show, or else I'll spend the next half hour on it.
Well, we don't have that kind of time, but we might.
But the thing about mansplaining, I just want to give your listeners a particular anecdote that happened to me just the other day, just this weekend. I was flying to Wisconsin to do, because I was brought in to do a speech on media issues, media and gender issues, at the University of Prattsville. And I was in a layover at O'Hare, and there was an older couple, like a senior citizen couple, sitting next to me, and I overheard them talking about something or other, and so I started chatting with them, and the woman asked me why I was going to this tiny town in Wisconsin, and so I told her I was there. The university had brought me in to do a speech, and she asked about what do you do, and I said, oh, I'm a media critic and a journalist. They're bringing me in to speak about gender and race issues in reality television and media economics in reality television. And her husband pops up, sort of gets really excited. He's like, television? I tweet about television. And then from that moment on, the woman who I'd been speaking to, she immediately ducks out of the conversation in that way that you can tell that she's been married to this guy for 30 or 40 years, and she knows that she's not going to get another word in
her
life.
Or even like 2 years.
Why even bother?
It doesn't really take that long. Two years.
And the guy starts talking about how he tweets about television. I say, that's great. Twitter is really wonderful for engaging around media issues. And he did not ask me, the journalist, the author, the media expert who's brought to his state to talk about television. He didn't ask me one question. He didn't ask me what the title of the book was or the subject or the speech, nothing. He just kept wanting to talk about his Twitter feed about television, and then he would say, oh, what do you think about this particular show, and then not wait for my answer and go into all his thoughts about a particular show. And I was just looking at him like, wow, you're really enamored of your own ideas as a hobbyist. But you have this expert in front of you who said, you know, you're welcome to come to this speech in your small town if you're interested. But he just kept not hearing anything or wanting to know anything about my expertise, just wanting to explain television to me, even though I'm the one being paid to go to talk about television and educate hundreds of students at the university. And then he finally shows me his Twitter feed. He, like, takes his phone out and shows me his phone. And it's like, Twitter's really great because occasionally you'll write about something and one of the writers or the producers of a show, they'll write back to you, and somebody will retweet you, and then somebody else will retweet you, and suddenly you have 500 followers. And so I was done, because I tried to have engaged conversation, and I just looked at him, and I showed him my phone, and I said, yeah, you're right, Twitter's really wonderful, and sometimes they retweet you, and you have 21,000 followers.
Jen, what do you do when what is the appropriate response when you're getting mansplained? Because outrage is just going to cause us all to have early heart attacks.
Oh, exactly. That's why I told this story about the O'Hare layover guy, and how I said, you know, oh yeah, no, it's great. Sometimes you have 21,000 followers like I have. Like, oh, you should have stopped talking to him as soon as he did that. And you should have given his wife your business card and walked away. And it's like, well, no, because his wife was no longer talking to me. And that would have appeared rude, and it would have reinforced his false notions that feminists are somehow, you know, oversensitive or whatever. The outrage industry.
I got to tell you, I've had the experience of male students not male students who are 20 years younger than me look at me as if I don't know anything until they get their first, you know, C minus. And then they ask me why. And then I explain to them why they got a C minus, and they realize that it's about the academia and it's not not because their opinion is appropriate. Now, we're running low on time. I want to take this call because this man is calling with a question, and let's see how we answer it. Okay, Jen?
C-.
Jen, you still there?
Yes.
I'm here.
Okay. Hey, Paul from Staten Island, you have a question that you wanted to air.
Yes. You were talking about that a lot of women responded to her position.
Yeah.
I was wondering, is it, what class, do you know the demographics, but it's the college-educated, professional, successful,
Wait, Jen, let him finish the question. Paul, what's the end of the question?
So you're automatically just jumping on it. Now, do you know if there was any working women who were working two jobs and trying to survive, or is it just sort of like this? That's the problem with the liberals. College,
yeah.
Sort of like intellectual.
We expected to be treated like equals. That's the problem with us. What do you mean?
Did I say that?
No, kind of.
I'm asking you, what about, do you know the demographics of all the women that responded?
That's okay, hold on. Let's find out. Paul, stay on the line. Go ahead, Jen.
So when I was talking about Rebecca's essay, she never used the word, Rebecca Solnit, the author, she never used the word mansplaining in her essay. She was talking about the concepts and trying to elucidate this sort of cultural phenomenon in which knowledge is perceived as belonging to men, and that women are not seen as having access to intellectual equity and substance and knowledge. And so when she wrote that essay, women all over the place, throughout the country, I'm answering now, women across the country, not just in academia, women on the internet who talked about, as well as writers, people would talk about this happening to them. Women who were police officers talked about this happening to them. Women who were doctors talked about that. Women who worked at Walmart talked about this happening to them. This was not something that was sort of an ivory tower fun project. This was a concept that took off because it resonated across the board, across ethnicity, across class, and across
age. Why doesn't that sound true?
Because you're from Staten Island.
I wouldn't say it. Okay,
no.
Jen,
hold on a second. Jen, no, Paul, are you there?
Yeah, what is there a problem with Staten Island?
No, I'm making a joke. It was a joke.
That wasn't a joke?
Well, it kind of was.
Juliana's a comedian. She's saying that it's Staten Island because that was,
I'm saying, I mean, here's the
reason,
deal.
But the reason, let me answer, because the
where
reason
you
that it sounds unusual.
What? No, I didn't go to Harvard.
What school did you go to, Harvard?
No.
No, I did not go to Harvard.
Neither of us went to Harvard. The men there wouldn't let us in. Just kidding!
I want to go back to what Paul was saying, what you were saying before. You asked, why does this not sound true? It doesn't sound true because you haven't experienced it, and that's not your fault. It's not. There's nothing wrong with you not experiencing it.
I'm saying, did you do the demographic study of...
Yeah, she answered you. She said, yeah, there were people who worked at Walmart, different kinds of people, female police officers. Yeah, do me a favor. Go ask your sister and your mom if they've ever had this experience, and then call us back tomorrow, okay? Monday.
I'll talk to my Harvard,
I want you to talk to the people that you believe would never have experienced the man talking down to them.
I never said that.
That's what you're suggesting.
The demographics of...
And I answered you about the demographics,
and you said
it didn't sound true.
Yeah.
When you got the answer that you asked for, you immediately rejected the answer as not sounding true, which is itself.
It sounded like you
got an answer from some somebody who was on the radio to explain this problem, and you asked for an answer and you got it, and then you said it didn't sound true, which is pretty much a definition of the problem we're talking about.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Paul, for being an example of mansplaining. Thank you, Jen, for being on the show. You're fabulous. Jen, you're fantastic. That was great. God, you're good at this. Jen, maybe, have you ever considered a career in media, Jen?
Doing this for a living? I don't know. Maybe I should. Blink, blink, licks on lollipop.
Paul, thanks for calling. I know we ribbed you a little bit. I like it when they call, even when they hate us. You know, or when they... Nah, he didn't say he hated me, but, you know, I like it when they call, even when they are... They perfectly make an example of exactly what we're talking about. Jen, I'm going to have you back on another time. We have like 4 minutes left, 2 minutes left, and there's a caller online who wants to share something about the beginning, the thing that was on at the beginning. This is a topic that requires a full hour. Will you come back and continue this conversation with us?
Sure.
All right. We've been talking with my good friend and media critic, media literacy speaker, the director, founding director of Women in the Media and News, and the author of the book Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, Jennifer Posner. All right, we're going to take the call. Tom, you've been patiently waiting. You wanted to make a comment about our first section.
Yes.
Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. We got about a minute.
I'd like to say this, that it was a hot summer day, and I was on the subway train. This is a true story.
Okay.
And when I was on there, there was a guy opposite me where I was sitting that had a big golf bag, and he had five or six big guns or rifles hanging out of the bag. Along comes a cop. He sees the bag. The guy gets arrested. It makes the newspaper the next day. What happened was that they were the Contras that were actually buying guns and shipping them to the war zone.
Wow.
And when the United States government saw that, probably in the newspaper, they decided to fund the Contras after that story.
Mm.
But I saw it personally. And the guy said, I'm not trying to hurt anybody in the U.S. We're shipping this to the government of down there.
Guatemala.
And
El Salvador.
And El Salvador. And that's what happened. That's how that started.
Wow.
Saw it personally.
What's your name, Tom? That's fascinating. How did that, I'm assuming that stayed with you for your whole life since then.
Obviously, I've seen quite a number of different things, but that is one of the things that has stayed with me. And when I heard you talk about that with your guest there, it brought all those memories back.
This is not an area where I have a ton of expertise.
No, I understand that.
Yeah, but
we can look up
the guy, the Gary Webb deep cover story, which we've talked about once or twice here, but that's a good story. Thanks a lot for your call, Tom. Sorry we have to go. We're all out of time. You're listening to the Giuliana Forlano Show. Man, sometimes we have guests that they both could have used an hour. Good topics. Very interesting. I hope you enjoyed that as much. I would have loved to take your calls, but I'll do it at another time. You can find us online, GiulianaForlano.com. All of these shows, if you missed any of them, are up there. Give it a day or two after airing on WBAI in New York, and they'll be up there. You can also catch us on the Progressive Voices Radio Network tonight. Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday at midnight. Thanks for listening. Good night.